Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. I suspect that we have all heard that phrase. I also suspect we all know what it means. And thirdly, I suspect that we have all been on one side or another of that phrase, and quite possibly at one point or another, we may have experienced being both the deceiver and the deceived. There are many examples of deceit in the movies, including two of my Christmas favorites, Christmas in Connecticut and It Happened on Fifth Avenue. Also fun movies, but both with multiple characters deceiving one another. And just this week, we watched Woman of Straw with Sean Connery as a well-to-do gentleman using deceit to get Gina Lola Brigida to do his dirty work. Eventually in these movies, as Hollywood is apt to do, we are treated to a happy ending, and everyone turns up a winner. Love overcoming deceit. Well, not for Sean Connery. He ends up mostly dead by the movie's end. Yet upon further examination of these motion picture examples, do these endings represent how things really work out in life, making everyone a winner? Or might we end up more often like Sean, mostly dead? Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Even when we examine the pages of a better source, the Bible, it doesn't take us long to find the first example of deceit, Eve's encounter with the serpent in Genesis chapter 3. And it takes just a matter of seconds to see the first fruits of deceit, more deceit. And then the punishment, a separation from the plethora of good things God had in store for the couple, and actually for all of humanity. When Adam and Eve fell, it started a pattern of sin that all of humanity was more than happy to follow. I now move our story of deceit forward in the pages of Genesis to the travails of a man named Joseph. They were journeying along a well-traveled route, these wandering traders, Midianites, Ishmaelites, perhaps others, traveling a route linking Egypt with all the varied places and cities to the north, places where they could go to sell things they produced in their home countries on the Arabian Peninsula. The sale of various items would bring much-needed funds home to their families, along with the balms, gum, and myrrh that had been acquired in Gilead. Keep that in mind as we sing our last hymn today. They surely had traveled this route countless times before. This time would be slightly different. Let's set the stage for the first part of our story. How and why is it that these nomadic traders happened upon and then bought our young man Joseph? Joseph is mentioned in 14 chapters in the book of Genesis, more than any other Old Testament character. Something else I came to realize as I was listening to my friends Alistair Begg, Paul Shepherd, and Chuck Swindoll in preparation for this message, they each did numerous sermons on the life of Joseph for their studies. The story is found in Genesis chapter 37, verse 18. When they, the brothers, saw him, Joseph, from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we will say, a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what becomes of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the varicolored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty, without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother and our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in blood. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. I began this message speaking of the web of deceit, and certainly we will be discussing that. But just as present in this story is the sin of jealousy, and that will also be addressed in all of its unattractiveness. When Joseph was still a distance away, his brothers were plotting to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said. "We'll kill him and throw him in this pit until Dad a wild animal ate him. And then we'll see what becomes of his dreams." His own brothers wanted to kill him over a dream and then deceive Jacob into thinking that a wild animal ate him? There has to be more to this story than that. But before they act on this idea, Reuben, Joseph's oldest brother, protests. "Don't kill him," he reasoned. "Just throw him in the pit, you know, to scare him." As much as he also disliked Joseph, at least Reuben didn't want to kill him. And we are told Reuben was plotting to come back later and rescue Joseph and return him to his father. So when Joseph got close enough to his brothers, they stole his robe and threw him into the empty cistern, and then nonchalantly sat down to have a nice lunch as if nothing had happened. Can you imagine Joseph at the bottom of the pit yelling out to his brothers, "Okay, guys, joke's over. Enough is enough. Get me out," as they callously sat down to eat their lunch. I think back to the Civil War, and I know you were expecting a reference from the Civil War at least once in this message, so here it is. I think back to the nights after a battle, when the troops had not yet left the area, how the heartrending and hideous cries of the wounded fell on the ears of the living soldiers as the wounded lay unattended on the field where they fell. How unbearable it was to listen to, but how impossible it was to risk lending any aid. Joseph's brothers could clearly hear his cries of anguish, yet they didn't care. But when they saw a caravan of traders coming down the road, they discussed selling Joseph to these strangers, much the same way as we might sell an old possession that had become useless to us. "Why kill the boy if we can make a profit from him?" his brother Judah reasoned, and the rest of the brothers agreed. So as the Midianite traders approached them, the brothers rescued Joseph from the pit and sold him for 20 pieces of silver, the going rate for a slave. As Joseph was being led away to Egypt, a place so far from home that the brothers were confident that they were never going to have to see his smug face again, they pretended to take some comfort from the fact that they did well in not killing him, for he was, of course, of their own flesh and blood. Reuben, who had apparently not been sharing lunch with the brothers, returned to find the pit empty, as barren now as his plan was to rescue Joseph, and he was distraught. After watching the caravan disappear in the distance, Joseph's brothers dipped his robe in goat's blood and began their trip home to convince Jacob of what had happened to his favorite son. I go back to verse 32. "And they sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father. And he said, 'We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not.' Then he examined it and said, 'It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces.' So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, 'Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son.' So his father wept for him." How could Joseph's brothers have hated the young man so much that they would conceive such a plan? Was there something about his robe that drove the boys to this point? Had they so little respect for their father Jacob that they would kill this beloved son of his and lie to him and let him suffer, even to his grave. Deceits and jealousies were running amok. So let's back the story up and see how we got to this point. And we go back to verse 12. Verse 12. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them." And Joseph said, "I will go." And he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. A man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are, pasturing the flock." Then the man said, "They have moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. We are told here that the brothers were away from the family home pasturing the flock, finding food and water that may not have been available near their home. There remains some question as to why Joseph had not accompanied his brothers on this trip. What we can say, though, is that at some point in time, Jacob felt the need to know how the boys and the flocks were doing. We do know that eventually God used this entire episode for good, but this long journey and how events unfolded did not go as expected for anyone. Matthew Henry, in his commentary, points out many parallels between the life of Joseph and the life of Jesus. We find one of them in this part of our story. The dutiful Joseph, beloved of his father, agreeing readily to follow his father's orders to go and find his missing brothers. "I will go," he replied in verse 13. Though he knew that the brothers hated and envied him, he went in search of them. Henry says, "It is a very good lesson, though it is learnt with difficulty and rarely practiced, to love those that hate us." Parallel between Joseph and Jesus changes a bit here. I'm not sure Joseph would have envisioned the evil his brothers would plot against him upon finding them. Jesus knew the evil in the hearts of his enemy. The fact that Joseph continued on from Shechem to Dothan rather than turning back showed that he was dedicated to finding his brothers, thus fulfilling his father's will. Find them he did. And that is where his troubles were to begin. Or is that where his troubles first began? I think we still need to jump back a bit further in this story to find out why these brothers would wish to kill their, as we shall find out, slightly pampered and apparently well-dressed sibling. We turn to the beginning of Genesis chapter 37. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph was 17 years of age and was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was a son of his old age, and he made him a vari-colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. I suppose you have all heard the phrase, "home, sweet home." Perhaps you have had a plaque bearing that slogan on one of your walls. Have any of you heard the phrase, "house, sweet house"? Have you ever wondered why this is? You see, a house really has no personality on its own. It's only when you add people to the recipe that a house takes on a life. Different emotions will come to mind based on the life of the family that lives there. If those emotions are pleasant, the house becomes a place of sweet abode. If the emotions are not pleasant, the word "sweet" is absent. In the case of Joseph's home life, family feud may have been a more apt description. Outside of his genealogy, we don't know much about Joseph before we read this 37th chapter of Genesis. By now, he is 17 years old or so. By the second verse, we jump right into the field of sheep to find Joseph out with his brothers, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, Reuben and Judah, names of just some of the sons of the various wives and handmaids that Father Jacob had. spoiler alert, maybe this convoluted family makeup is already an underlying problem. Just saying. So the boys were all out pasturing the flock. And right off the bat, we have an issue. We find out that Joseph brings back a bad report on his brother's behaviors. Now, we don't know what this bad report contained. Was it some egregious mistake that would endanger someone or the brothers themselves? Were they being lazy in their work? Or were they maybe making sport of Joseph? We don't know. What we do know was that this favorite son of dad ratted out his brothers. Why did Joseph feel comfortable tattling on the boys? Do you remember tattling on a sibling or friend as you were growing up? How often did it end up backfiring on you? It backfired in this case. You see, Joseph may have felt a bit entitled. He was dad's favorite, and that fact was obvious to everyone by this time. 17 years ago, Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, had finally given Jacob a son. It wasn't Jacob's first son, the one that perhaps deserved to be the favorite. And I say that given the fact that I am a first son. No, this was Jacob's, 11th son, give or take. But make no mistake about it, this one was a favorite. And what do you do as a parent with a favorite son? You end up making sure that everyone knows. Perhaps you even give this son, and only this one son, a special robe. You know the one I'm talking about. The robe with the long sleeves, the low hemline, maybe made of colorful yarns. The kind of attire that smacked more of nobility in those days. And the kind that made physical labor difficult. Perhaps while wearing such a robe, much labor was not even required of the wearer. We are not told any of the other boys received such a gift. I was listening to Dennis Prager this week, and he posed the question, why do we not teach our children the evils of envy? Envy, jealousy, same thing, different word. Do we teach our children about envy? I think we give it lip service, but actions often speak louder than our words. We see others with things that we think we should have. Then we plan on how to get them. Too often, our current culture would teach us that not only should we be given things we are jealous over, but that others should have to give those hard-earned things up for us. Do you remember as a child fighting with another child over a toy that they were playing with because you wanted it? And remember what happened? Mom took it away from both of you and nobody had it. Jealousy reigned over Joseph's beautiful robe and what it represented. And the brothers reasoned that if they didn't have one, he shouldn't have one. 3,000 years since that episode, and I suggest that we haven't made too much progress over envy yet, have we? Okay, so Joey has a nice robe, and he doesn't work as hard as the other boys. But let's look at verse 4 again. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. And his fathers loved him more than all his brothers. Had they actually seen this played out in their lives? Let's go back a few years to the hill country near Gilead and read of Jacob's meeting with his brother Esau. You know, the one who Jacob cheated out of the family birthright. Genesis chapter 32, verse 6. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And now moving forward to chapter 33, then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. Jacob was hiding Joseph and his mother in the rear of the column, putting the rest of the boys farther to the front, where they were exposed to the greater danger. But I suspect this favoritism may have existed in the family even before these episodes. Do any of you remember an anti-smoking commercial from 1967? Hands up. And at the end of the commercial, the dad sat down under a tree and pulled a package of cigarettes out of his pocket, lit one up, and set the pack on the ground close to his son. As the little boy picked up the package of cigarettes and looked it over, the voiceover announcer said, "Like father? Like son? Think about it." Reminders like that give us a glimpse of where some of our habits are learned. And we had a little reference to that in our gospel today. If we go back to verse 38, and Jesus said, "I speak the things which I have seen from my Father. Therefore, you also do the things which you have heard from your father." Let's look back a bit at Genesis chapter 25. Now, Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Jacob had learned the ways of favoritism from his mother, but he had not yet learned the cost of favoritism. Now, years later, in Genesis 33, he was staring the results of that favoritism right in the face as he prepared to meet his brother on the plains. But did the fear he faced that day replay in his mind as he began to establish a favorite in his own family years later? Paul Shepherd states that favoritism is a sin. While I may not quite fall into that camp myself, I have to admit that no good fruit would seem to come from it. But take note in this story of Rebekah and her son Jacob. A parallel line of jealousy is forming right in line with the favoritism. Rebekah was putting together a plan to steal the blessing Esau was rightfully to receive from his father Isaac and give it to her son. And running right alongside these improprieties was the sin of deceit. Because we see, with Jacob's help, she deceived her own husband into giving Esau's blessing to Jacob. In this story, we experience the movements of various sins, weaving themselves in and out until they form a tapestry that becomes too hard to tear apart. An all too familiar story of sins piling, one on top of the other, that we will again see in the story of David and Bathsheba. This travesty was now repeating itself in the lives of Jacob and Joseph. Jacob was also in the process of learning how history repeats itself, a lesson we would all do well to take to heart. So we've established that Joseph is Pop's favorite, and as our favorite orange cat Garfield would say, big, fat, hairy deal, right? Well, we started with deceit. Now we've introduced jealousy into this story. Flat out, the boys were jealous. And we've all seen how jealousy eats at us. As verse 4 states, so they hated him. Let's move to verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we are binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Let's kill that dreamer, they had stated earlier. As we look at Joseph's dream, we see him sharing a vision of his brothers bowing down to him, and they hated him for this too. Yet Joseph wasn't finished. He shared a second dream that foretold not only of his brothers bowing down to him, but his father and mother as well. Visions that were to be fulfilled many years down the road, but visions that were not appreciated or understood at this time. "Let's kill the dreamer," they said on the plains of Dothan. "And then let's see what becomes of his dreams." You kill the dreamer, you kill the dreams. They tried that with Joseph. It was tried years later with Jesus. But in both cases, what do you do with the father that loved the son? In our story today, they showed the father a bloodied robe. Jacob was learning the cost of making one son an obvious favor. There's a lot more to the story of Joseph that, for time's sake, we will need to leave for another day. Part 2, perhaps? As I close now and leave Joseph in the hands of the Midianite traders, I would like to go back to the cinema. Not the most sterling encyclopedia of lessons to go back to, but somewhat apt in this case. I reference Frank Capra's 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, with Jimmy Stewart. George Bailey, Jimmy Stewart's character, has experienced a life full of, as he would believe, rotten luck. And by the end of the movie, George has deceived himself into thinking his life has not been worth living at all. It took the presence of Clarence the Angel to convince him that those thoughts were nothing but deceit. That George had fulfilled a wonderful purpose for his life. A life that just didn't progress as George had hoped it would. We didn't spend much of this message looking at this story from Joseph's perspective. But I ask you now to do just that. Joseph is now on his way to who knows where and for what purpose. Abandoned by those he loved, who apparently did not love him in return. A story of humiliation, but ultimate exaltation. Very similar, as Matthew Henry surmises, to the life of Christ. A story of tribulations many have and or will go through before entering the kingdom of heaven. What was Joseph to hang on to at this time? Did he remember the dreams God had given him? The dreams of ruling over his brothers? What could they mean to him now? These visions were perhaps all he had to cling to in his hour of trial. Are any of us in a season of trial where God's promises are all we have to hang on to? Clinging to these promises, will we maintain our integrity and overcome the deceits, jealousies, and other various sins of our past so that our futures can proceed as God had planned for us? Or will we refuse to learn from history and continue to make our same mistakes? Joseph's story will continue in Genesis chapter 39. Our story continues as we walk out of these doors today. Amen.